Okay, folks, you should have your Bibles open to 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2. And we're going to now look at a section in a book that was written to the remnant of Israel who's going to exist out in the day of the Lord's wrath as Peter takes these works of darkness that have now developed as the evolution of man's ungodliness has developed to their great status, their extreme or excessive state. We read in those first 9 verses at the end of our last lesson there, and we may come back here again. I mentioned, I mentioned Sodom and Gomorrah gets mentioned there by Peter to drop that into the thinking of the remnant there. Just to mention one thing about it before we move on, in the way the world of the ungodly was redeveloping, even though it wasn't very far along, by the time you get to Genesis 18 and 19 there was an attempt by Satan at that time on a very limited scale. It was kind of on a limited operation of the adversary in connection with, you know, he had a very short period of time here, relatively speaking, and then God judged that. Then he started the New World Order, and of course, Satan doesn't know, God's not telling Satan every single thing about it, so he's got to make he's got to test the waters a little bit. He, very quickly, when you get to Genesis chapter 18 and 19 there, you've got Israel now coming onto the scene through Abraham. He's been saved and established as the father of this new nation, one of the patriarchal fathers of it. So Satan, I think very commonsensically, would test to see just how far can I get this night going? Is it going to be something I can really do? And I think that's what was going on here back in Sodom and Gomorrah, where he was testing the waters regarding kind of testing his own capacity to produce the world of the ungodly at large again. And he took this very small portion of humanity down there, if you can envision that area where you have the Sea of Galilee and then you've got the Jordan River that goes down into the dead, we call it the Dead Sea, the Salt Sea. And right at the southern curvature of that Dead Sea were these 5 cities. Sodom, Gomorrah, Zeboim, I can't remember the others, but there were these 5 cities that were down there. And Satan went down in that area with the intent on taking that small portion of humanity. And these people were in such great debauchery already. Some of these things were already among them so much so that they were kind of like consigned over to him to see what he could do with them, and was willing to operate in connection with anything that the adversary wanted. And with that small community, he actually took all 3 of these categories of the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, and those subcategories of darkness, and he kind of saturated that whole community and that whole society with them. And in a many-type way, Sodom and Gomorrah isn't just homosexuality. There was an awful lot more going on there. And in a way, it was kind of a mini type of a society of great ungodliness that was produced. So much so that it served as an ensample and an example to the rest of humanity when God judged that. And so, again, Before we move on, I'm going to do this. Don't mean to gross you out, but I'm going to do this. The Bible is the Bible. It's a very real book. I mentioned this chapter several times. Come back to Leviticus chapter 20 or chapter 18. Just going to read through some of this. All right. So we were Sodom and Gomorrah takes place, Genesis 18, 19. Then you move on to the law, Mount Sinai, Moses, the law is given. After the law is given in its initial state, God now adds to that law here in the book of Leviticus. So when the laws are given to the nation of Israel concerning these things, understand that what I'm about to read are things that came from the world at large that were depicted in a many way here at Sodom and Gomorrah, and that now permeate the world at large, the Gentiles. And this, by the way, is your heritage, because we're all Gentiles, and our whole genealogy can go back to this. This is the kind of thing that, you know, Peter will talk about. Well, we'll mention, let the word do the talking. Pick it up here, just a little bit of what I'm after here at verse 20. Leviticus chapter 18. Now, this is the law. So this is being incorporated as part of Israel's law. We're not under the law, we're under grace. So I'm not saying that we're going to obey all of this, or this was written directly to us, but for Israel, this gives you an idea of some of the stuff that was going on. When I said in last session that some of these ideas that people have is that they're being liberated, the mind is finally being free, we're finally throwing off the shackles, and we can finally, you know, make no mistake, everything like Roe v. Wade, all of these kinds, this is just so man can have sex with who he wants, when he wants, where he wants, with no consequences whatsoever. And there's a lot more involved in that kind of sexual wantonness and the debauchery and all of that. Well, Israel picked this up from the Gentiles. And here, God is making it so that they make sure that they don't do these things by incorporating this into their law. Verse 20 says, "Moreover, thou shalt not lie carnally with thy neighbor's wife." By the way, if you read the first 19 verses, you really get an education in God's terminology when he uses such phrases as uncovering the nakedness. And it also shows you the modesty of the Bible. You think this is going to be very graphic, but believe me, God could be much more graphic than what he is. The Bible, as I showed you before, goes up to a particular point and says, you know, I'm not going to describe it anymore. That's why what we looked at over in Ephesians 5, things that are not even should be mentioned. There in Genesis 6, when God describes the incident that took place with Noah and Ham and Canaan, he doesn't tell you what it is. Personally, I don't want to know. I can't unread that. It's like, I can't unsee that. I've got to poke my mind's eye out. Anyway, so this is pretty graphic, but it could be far worse, and it was. But verse 20, he says, "Moreover, thou shalt not lie carnally with thy neighbor's wife to defile thyself with her. And thou shalt not let any of thy seed pass through the fire to Molech." This is child sacrifices that were taking place according to the corrupted religions of the Gentiles. "Neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God." And it's interesting how many times the Lord does this. "I am," hearkening back to Exodus chapter 3, "I am the capital O, capital O, capital R, capital D." That's the whole issue here. I am the Lord, Jehovah. Not Satan, not Baal. Baal means Lord in Hebrew. The word Lord there isn't Lord in Hebrew. The word Lord there is Jehovah in Hebrew. But that's the issue. That's the contention. Who is Lord Most High? Who's going to be your bread provider? That's what the word Lord means. The one who provides you bread. Anyway, verse 22, "Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is abomination." And that is exactly what it means, folks. Men with men. Men having sex with men. "Neither shalt thou lie with any beast to defile thyself therewith." And you know what that means. "Neither shall any woman stand before a beast to lie down thereunto. It is confusion." I'm sure it is for the beast. Defile not yourselves. Well, if you can't have a sense of humor about this, why... That goat is confused. That's not supposed to come out of the pulpit. "Defile ye and not ye yourselves in any of these things, for in all these the nations are defiled, which I cast out before you. And the land is defiled. Therefore I do visit the iniquity upon it, and the land itself vomiteth her out her inhabitants. Ye shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not commit any of these abominations, neither any of your own nation, nor any stranger that sojourneth among you. For all these abominations, have the men of this of the land done, which were before you, and the land is defiled, that the land spew not you out also when ye defile. Notice when you do it. Not if you do it, when you do it. And it did do that. It finally vomited Israel out. That's what they did when they went under the fifth course of punishment under the times of the Gentiles. The land of Israel got so putrefied of the nation of Israel being like these nations that it vomited them out. And that's why, folks, when we come over to in just a few minutes and read in 2 Peter, that's why Peter says the dog returns to his own vomit. You're supposed to make connections. Oh, I remember when God said something about vomit back there in Leviticus 18 to the nation of Israel. He said, ends by saying, "For whosoever shall commit any of these abominations, even the souls that commit them, shall be cut off from among their people. Therefore shall ye keep mine ordinances, that ye commit not any one of these abominable customs which were committed before you, and that ye defile not yourselves therein. I am the Lord your God." That doesn't sound like cultural tolerance. Somebody told me today that it is now being said that professors in colleges in the United States cannot use in their history classes the term melting pot. We don't want this nation to be a melting pot anymore. That's bad terminology. No, everybody's going to stand with their own customs and their own religions and their own this and that. Well, they did this all before. The United States is returning to her vomit. That's what's happening. But this is a listing of some of the stuff that was going on in the nations and in the world, and I just want to show you that because that stuff right there has been going on for millennia. People think they can come up with a new way of being debauched. No, it's an old way. It's just more intensified. All right. Come back to 2 Peter chapter 2. Now, as we go on through this, the rest of this chapter, there's one other thing we need to know so that we understand what's happening here in kind of not just context, but the way, and I don't have time to go into great detail on this, but I have to mention it because you might be scratching your head in 2 Peter, thinking, well, now, these things don't seem to be quite as clear-cut as they were before. They're not. What I mean is, when you read through the rest of the chapter, in chapter 2 of 2 Peter, much like we did with Isaiah, what we're going to do, when we were in Isaiah chapter 2, 3, and 5, I said, let your ear listen to the terminology and begin to pick up on the kind of expressions and terms and phrases that might match up with either the great prideful thinking and the haughtiness, or the great sexual wantonness, or the great debauchery of corruption. And let your ear pick that terminology up and a light go on. However, this is the difference. This is not the warning, but this is the big point. When you come to 2 Peter, and again, 2 Peter comes right before 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and then you get Jude, and those epistles of John sandwiched between Peter's epistles and Jude, where you have John taking what Peter says here, and then it's really intensified in 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and they have to put the litmus test to all that Peter sets out here. When you get to this point in God's Word, something has happened to these three categories. You're going to find you're not going to see things so clearly cut in those nice three delineated, separated almost categories in that type of a manner like we found back in Isaiah. There's a reason for that. They're not. They're jumbled. They're mixed together. They're not random, but they are put together in a different way. Now, when you get them kind of mixed up, because at this point, the issue is, that's exactly what's taking place when the day of wrath is here. When and you won't be here for this day of wrath, you will be taken off. But the remnant will be here of Israel. They'll be They'll be operating and functioning as the light of the world, and they're going to have to deal with these kinds of things. But what I'm after is, when you get to this point in the program, the things the adversary has designed for these three things to kind of, in his mind, to take these three things you see up here and kind of bring them all into one. To take the three, I don't have three arms, but to take the three and to bring them all into one. Just one big ball of works of darkness. That's because they're reaching their climactic point where they're all going to work together. It's kind of like I got a good analogy, but it's a really bad analogy. It's a good analogy because it's kind of like it, but it's not at all like it. It's kind of like, remember the four decision-making skills you learn as a son: wisdom, justice, judgment, equity. But you learn that there's four of them, but you learn that they are all designed to go together. They can all operate. Well, that's why I say that way that they operate, that's a good illustration. But it's a bad illustration because this is so opposite of that. This is what the adversary's doing. He's taking these works of darkness in their general categories, and he keeps moving them and growing them along with the evolution of man's ungodliness to where they finally come together and they finally join together. They are joined together, but they really join and operate almost as an entity among themselves. They take on almost a life of themselves. And that's what's happening in 2 Peter. And so that's why when you read down through here, things aren't as clear cut. And so he's doing that to work these together to the benefit of his finest hour when his man of sin comes on the scene. And these are all designed to one day work together to be able to all manifest together in all men in general these ungodly aspects, so that, again, they will gladly sign on with the man of sin. They're not going to come along and not take the mark of the beast. They're going to say, I want it. Give it to me. So anyway, God's going to have Peter deal with all three categories, my point is, but in a more collective way than in everything else he's said. Well, again, I'm going to read through this section. Let's see if we can pick up on some of the terms and phrases that line up with some of these categories as more detailed and defined examples of them. I'm going to pick this up in verse 10, read through a bunch of this, and then we're going to start putting some things up here on the board in connection with it, all right? So let's begin in verse 10. You can follow along there in your Bible. It says, "But chiefly them that walk after the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise government. Presumptuous are they, self-willed. They are not afraid to speak evil of dignities. Whereas angels, which are greater in power and might, bring not railing accusation against them before the Lord." By the way, if that ought to really click in your thinking, where you say, hey, the remnant's taught some things about government like we're taught. Yeah, they are. Not even the angels are going to bring railing accusation against those dignities before the Lord. "But these, as natural brute beasts..." Now stop right there for a moment. I'm not going to put that on the board. That terminology, all I'm going to do today is I'm going to tell you that is extremely significant. Because the brute beast issue, that comes up again in Jude, and it's indicative of what state of affairs things were in when the vessels of wrath were fitted to destruction here in Acts chapter 7 at the stoning of Stephen. When God had the Lord Jesus Christ stand to judge, to have that day, instead set him down for this day, for the dispensation of grace. But that brute beast issue was developed here, it's maintained here, and it's going to take its final step out there. And that's what you get, even today, in among many of these, and what you're going to encounter when you encounter the adversary and his policy of evil. You're going to encounter the brute, beastish nature of the world at large. That is a major issue And I can't go into that in detail at all right now, but just docket that in the back of your mind that that's a big deal to God. Again, what do you do in evolution? What is man? What are you taught? What is the one of the most fundamental things you're taught in evolution? We're all the same. We're the same what? Animals. That's right. You're taught that man's an animal. You keep telling a man he's an animal long enough, don't come to me and cry and whine about it when he acts like one and when he acts out like one. And if you want to see little animals, go to any public elementary school from kindergarten through sixth grade. You'll see brute beast behavior. You'll see animals, human beings acting like animals with no restraints. And any restraints that you try to put on them, you will be met with a lawsuit about it. We are legislating animal behavior. Don't think we're not. And don't think that the next guy or girl you vote in is going to make it any different. Anyway, I didn't mean to take a lot of time on the animal, the brute beast, but that's a big issue. But these, as natural brute beasts made to be taken and destroyed, speak evil of the things they understand not, and shall utterly perish in their own corruption. Notice corruption comes up again. And shall receive the reward of unrighteousness as they that count it pleasure to riot in the daytime. Spots they are. These are some terms that would be very indicative to a Jew, very meaningful to Jewish understanding. Spots they are, blemishes. Sporting themselves. Interesting that sporting comes up again. I remember when, well, anyway. Sporting themselves with their own deceivings while they feast with you, having eyes full of adultery that cannot cease from sin, beguiling unstable souls, and heart they have exercised with covetous practices. Cursed children, which have forsaken the right way and are gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. Remember when we studied Balaam, and I told you next to Leviticus 26 is probably one of the most important areas of the Bible to understand, to know how the Bible is to be laid out. But was rebuked for his iniquity. The dumb ass speaking with man's voice forbade the madness of the prophet. These are wells without water, clouds that are carried with a tempest, to whom the midst of darkness is reserved forever, for when they speak great swelling words of vanity, they allure through the lusts of the flesh, through much wantonness, those that were clean escaped from them who live in error, while they promise them liberty. There it is, freedom, liberty, enlightenment. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are servants of corruption. For of whom a man is overcome, of the same he is brought in bondage. For if after they have escaped the pollutions of the world through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, they are again entangled therein and overcome, the latter end is worse with them than the beginning. For it had been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness than after they have known it to turn from the holy commandment delivered unto them. But it has happened unto them according to the true proverb, and this is sitting back in the book of Proverbs, the dog is returned to his own vomit again, the sow that was washed to her wallowing in the mire. Some real Gentile terminology coming up there to describe all the advances and all the successes and all the evolution of the nations of the world. They've gone right back to their vomit. Well, did you catch some things? He said, catch some things. I think I need a shot. You go through a passage like that, you just want to take a shower. Peter's terminology there is different. I mean, there's something going on here that is really, really extreme because of all the verbiage that he uses that surrounds some of these things. That's why that I've stuck that word great up there as a short way just to remind you of the extremity of what has happened. This is a description of everything we've talked about right there when it's come to its zenith, when it's come to its nth degree, when that last click takes place and you go from the night being far spent to the time in which it's fully spent and Satan now can earn the right to have his finest hour or demand his right to it. Well, Did you catch some terms? I'm sure you did. We won't go over them, but you may want to put more than this on there, but I'm just going to put a few so that we can get some of them. And when it comes to these individual examples and these issues, remember that since the night was in its far spent status when the dispensation of grace was brought in, and since there is only that one final step, as I said, to it becoming fully spent, the difference in what's listed here in 2 Peter 2 and how things stand right now, if we are near the end of this, which I'm assuming we are, we may not be, but if we are, the way things stand now is really negligible. The difference in what's listed here and how things presently stand really isn't all that great of a difference at all. It's just one more step, so to speak. And about the only difference is going to be the extent. It's not going to be the actual things, but the intensity that it permeates all mankind, and the degree to which they become so, these things become so thick in man and so dense and so concentrated, and therefore all that much more blinding to the eyes of the understanding of men at large. And today we're simply witnessing, when we see what's going on out there, we're seeing the ongoing evolution of man's ungodliness in connection with these very things, the works of darkness. That's what's going on. And in preparation for these things written by Peter here to take place. Well, let's list some of these things before we go and see if we can't get through the whole list. If not, we'll get through most of it. And by further giving you some identifying characteristics and features and descriptions, what we're after here is to gain more intelligence and the more time in which we will, the more intelligent way we'll be able to cast these things off as the works of darkness they are and do it intelligently and intelligently reprove them by putting on the armor of light. Well, since we went through it this way in Isaiah, we'll go through it this way here. We'll start over here with the third one, the pride of life issue. Great prideful thinking, the haughtiness issue. Come back up to verse 10 where this all got started. Again, these are coming to a head, so they're going to be kind of, the list is going to look kind of mixed up. It's going to look kind of like everything is put together, and that's because it is, and it's because of the way in which the adversary is going to utilize these things. So we're going to have to pull them out of several places. Verse 10, but chiefly, he says, them that walk after the... Well, actually, what I'm after is the last sentence there in verse 10, especially. The last sentence of verse 10. Presumptuous are they, self-willed, they are not afraid to speak evil of dignities. The first one I would put up there under great prideful thinking is that issue of presumption. Presumptuous. Now, that's a word that maybe we don't use a whole lot. What is presumptuous? And by the way, I'm not going to get into a lot, I don't think I'm going to do this, into a lot of dictionary definition. You've got good dictionaries and you can do a lot of this work yourself. But just in general, when you look at somebody and you say they're presumptuous, at first that doesn't sound all that bad, does it? Yeah, they're a little presumptuous. They don't know as much as they think they do. Who else?
Take for granted.
I didn't hear you.
Take something for granted.
Yeah. Proud? Yeah, well, that's why it falls under pride. Yeah, they're definitely... Presumption is an issue of pride, of the pride of life. If you really think about the way the word... When you're what does the word presumptuous come from?
Presume.
Take over. Yeah, okay, take over something. And really, when you start dealing with a presumptuous person, you start looking at the shades of meaning of presumptuous... It comes down to really an issue of supposing the truth or reality of something without any proof of it. That's what it comes down to. When you're presuming something, if a lawyer in a court of law presumes something, is that a very good thing for a lawyer to do? Ho, 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 no. No, no, no. Lawyers will tear you up if you do not disclose everything to them. Because the last thing that they want to do is be presumptuous. They do not want to assume. You know what assuming does? that something is true when it's not. This is a very serious matter. I know presumptuous oftentimes isn't used very seriously. God is having Peter use this very seriously. If you think about presumptuous as someone supposing something is true or real without any proof of it, you've just basically stuck the entire realm of science in that one word. Most of science and most of what is taught to young people in this country as scientific truth is not truth, it's scientific theory. Theory is not truth. And by the way, evolution is not being taught as a scientific theory or even as a scientific fact. It's being taught as a religion. You know how I know that? Because if evolution truly was being approached and dealt with honestly as a science, science always allows for an opposing view to be taught with it. And it is refused. You cannot have creation taught along with evolution. That's getting into the realm of religion, where religion says, you just stay out of it. I don't care. Don't screw up my religion with facts. So that goes deep into a lot of things. I'm not just picking on evolution, but there's a lot of things that mankind will set forth as reality without any proof. And he's feeding his pride of life, his haughtiness. Think of how much of that goes against God. There is no God. There's no proof. Oh, really? Well, I think your proof is the proof that you have no proof, that your proof that I have no proof is lacking proof. We could spend some time on that one, but we need to move. I want to try to get some on here. Stay there in verse 10. Presumptuous are they, the next one. Self-willed. That is a pride of life aspect. That's an aspect of great prideful thinking and haughtiness. Self-willed. My will. Me, my. Not here. Remember when I'm going to use this word, I'm not even going to explain why I'm using it. If you know, then you've followed along for a long time and you've got making good connections. If not, don't worry about it. It's not that big of a deal. Self-willed is someone who is not amiable or amenable. Not amenable. I love the word amenable. Self-willed is someone who's not yielding to the will or wishes of others. Self-willed. You see that so much today. The idea, for instance, a good analogy is college campus today. If you want to see the place where self-will is promoted, it's there. You cannot have a whole bunch of ideas. You can only have one idea and all other ideas are shut out. That's being self-willed. You will not yield to the wishes or will of another. You won't even give them a hearing. And then he goes on in that verse and he says, they are not afraid to speak evil of dignities. Not afraid to speak evil of dignities. A dignity here is a person who is in a position of higher honor and rank and authority or degree. And this, to instead of putting not afraid to speak evil of dignities, I'm going to put on the board not so much a word that is used here, but a word that I think stands behind all that, and it's just incredible arrogance. Someone who is not afraid to speak evil of a dignity. This is arrogance in general. This is arrogance in a very powerful degree, but generally arrogance. And it's a term that encompasses the gist of that issue
there's another one that's going to come up that's very clear, close to that up in the first part of the verse, but it's actually under another section. But we'll let that go for right now. Not afraid to tear down or speak evil of those in high degree, high rank, or who are deserving of honor. Well, there's more in this from verse 10 through 22 here that we could get under the pride of life, and you can add some of those yourself. But I just want to get a sampling, kind of, to get the ball rolling.
And there's more than that, but let those three suffice for right now. Presumptuous, self-willed, arrogance. That's a little more defined than just great prideful thinking. Let's move to the second category here, the lust of the eyes. Great sexual wantonness. And pick up that first part of verse 10 again there. But chiefly, them that walk after the flesh in the lust of uncleanness. That, folks, is talking about sexual uncleanness. Lust of uncleanness. That is not, in the Greek, that's the only time that word is used in the Bible. That's not talking about just general uncleanness. This is talking about gross, extreme, gross sexual sin. It's talking about practices of sodomy. Sexual sin that is contrary to nature. I'm trying to be a little bit guarded here, so to speak. Defiling and dishonoring human nature sexually. That's what the lust of uncleanness is about here. And that, by the way, is something that actually in the Gentile religions gets incorporated into their religious practices. Anyway, I don't want to say too much more than that. I have to eat lunch, but that's not just uncleanness in the sense of the law. Uncleanness. That's uncleanness in a sexual sense. That's why it falls under the lust of the eyes. Great sexual wantonness. Cast your eye down to verse 14. That one should have jumped out at you. Verse 14, having eyes full of adultery. And by the way, just notice again, not just the word adultery, but how God has the Apostle Peter couch it in more terminology, full of adultery. Notice that the expressions, you'll see this in many of these, where it's not just talking about adultery in general, and it's not. Adultery in general is always sin. But there is this issue of full of adultery, this issue of adultery in this fullness kind of state is something that is particularly involved in the works of darkness. It's not just, well, this happened once and that's it. That's bad enough. But I'm talking about a society now, a humanity now, that's fueling at what they do. Eyes full of adultery. And again, that full issue indicating the extremeness of it or the greatness of it. And it isn't simply adultery, but having eyes full of adultery and that cannot cease from sin. That's what each one of these is dealing with. That's why I say, you know, we've got listed in there in Romans, and I'm not trying to make light of it at all, but you've got the issue of drunkenness. And yet the Bible doesn't come along and prohibit you from ever drinking alcohol. But drunkenness, and the truth of the matter is, if you've got a problem with alcohol, leave it alone. That's the only course to take. But what I'm talking about is taking something to an excess that now moves it out of just something that happened at one time, but into the real works of darkness. It's working in cooperation with the policy of evil now. And that's what he's describing here. Full of adultery, it cannot cease from sin. Look at verse 18. He talks about in verse 18, our very word that's in this list up here, great sexual wantonness, comes up. He says, for when they speak great swelling words of vanity, they allure through the lust of the flesh through much wantonness. And he talks about much wantonness there. And that's, again, unrestrained, ungodly lust. But again, you've got much there. And you can kind of put much wantonness there. So we've got three on one side, three in the middle. Let's get the last three and we'll call that a day. under the lust of the flesh, actually mentioned right there. Great debauchery. Look at verse 14. This one jumped out at me. And heart they have exercised with covetous practices. Exercised. I can't get all that on the board, so I'm just going to put covetous practices. But again, this is a word. You talk about a word like full or much that he's been. Now he's got exercised. When you exercise your body, the point that you're doing, the reason you're doing that is to make your body what? Stronger. To either to make your muscles stronger or to make your heart or your organs stronger. But the idea is to make it strong, to give them greater capacity, to make it so that you have greater stamina. So the issue is that when he says, and heart they have exercised with covetous, when you're exercising, you want your heart to get stronger and stronger in those covetous practice areas. Again, this is not just sin in general. This isn't just covetousness in general. But this is getting covetousness stronger and stronger and stronger so that you have more stamina with it. It's the final evolution of man's ungodliness that makes it so that he's going to come along and pledge his allegiance to the adversary and to his man of sin. And this is the issue of making that final transition. That's why all these little words that accompany the sin are there. That gives you that greatness issue. They're making that final transition with the works of darkness to embracing the man of sin, making the whole world now, when the evolution of man's ungodliness reaches its nth degree, it's become what? It's become satanly, like Satan, satanliness. Exercised with covetous practices. It's not just occasionally thinking or doing these things. It's the very character of who they are. And that goes for all the things mentioned in all these categories, everything we put up here on the board. But note again, practices. Covetous practices. That's being used in the same sense that you'd use it with a lawyer or a doctor. And I always wondered about a doctor. When's he going to stop practicing and start doing, you know? Been practicing medicine for a long time, yeah, but you've never really gotten good at it, you know. Well, just as a lawyer practices law or a doctor practices medicine, this is this guy's profession. That's what his profession is, covetousness. That's what he's doing about every waking hour of every day. And there's much more to covetous than just coveting money. Verse 13, and shall receive the reward of unrighteousness as they that count it pleasure to riot in the daytime. Well, that one's mentioned in our list in Romans, rioting. Riot in the daytime. And notice, count it pleasure to do so. It's a pleasure to them as they pursue their pleasures. That's one of the things they do. They riot. This is mob rule, the rule of a mob. And notice also you've got that general lust of the flesh mentioned there in verse 18, as I said. The last one I want to put on the board for today is the one that we looked at up there earlier in verse 10 that I said I'd come back to in the first sentence of verse 10. But chiefly them that walk after the flesh in the lust of uncleanness and despise government. There's a lust of the flesh issue of great debauchery, despising government, which is one of the reasons why they riot in the daytime. There, this kind of goes along with what we were looking at over in the arrogance issue over there earlier, when we were looking at not afraid to speak evil of dignities. And I wanted to hold off what I was going to say there for here as well, because it's not only part, and you can kind of see how these things can kind of link together very well, almost to be used as a single whole. And that's the way they're designed to be done by the adversary. But what I'm after in this is that when you see despising government here, there is a debauchery concept in connection with despising government. And some courses that men take in connection with those that are in positions of authority, like those dignities that not even the angels will speak against. A good example of that is governmental authority, maybe not so much in government itself, but government isn't just in the government. There's government, for instance, in a local school. A public school has a system of government. And if you want to really see despising government, you'll see it there. And one of the absolute insanity issues in public school is that they are despising government and yet demand the rule of law. You can't. And I mean despising government to the point where a child would sit in a classroom and call a teacher the worst and most vulgar things that he could call them, and then say, "You can't touch me." That is an expression of despising government. The government in that classroom is the teacher. She's the government, or